NPR's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening. Good afternoon and welcome to this special Main Street Radio show. I'm Rachel Reby, and we're broadcasting from Duluth on the edge of the Great North Woods that once covered much of Minnesota. There continues to be a great deal of debate on how to preserve and protect the forests that remain an important resource in our state. Our guests today have all been active participants in that conversation. Jim Sanders is the Forest Supervisor for the Superior National Forest, and Betsy Dobb is the Forest Program Director for the Minnesota State Office of the National Audubon Society. They're with me this afternoon at the Minnesota Public Radio Studios of WSCN, WSCD in Duluth. Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President for Minnesota Forest Industries, joins us from our St. Paul studio. Good afternoon to all of you and welcome.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Our phone lines are also open for your questions and comments. You can call us this afternoon at 1-800-537-5252. 1-800-537-5252. For 10 years, Minnesota has been talking about ways to improve forest practices. Millions of dollars have been spent to study the situation, and truckloads of reports have been generated. But let's start out with the question, are we making any progress? Betsy, your response?
Well, I guess it depends on who's opinion you take.
Your opinion.
Okay. Not enough. Certainly not nearly enough. We've been doing a lot of conversation with a lot of different interest groups at the table in Minnesota, and that sounds good and indeed is progress over many places in the country where there's not that kind of talking occurring. But if the real measure of success is have we made improvements on the ground in the forests, no, we haven't yet. It's been 10 years of conversations, talking about improvements, but we haven't yet seen that trickle down to real change on the ground. And I think in large part because we don't really see yet a commitment from all the players to those improvements.
Wayne Brandt, your thoughts?
Well, if commitment doesn't include our members in the Timber Producers Association spending $40 million in the past 4 years on lower ground pressure and more environmentally sensitive logging equipment, if that's not commitment, if commitment is not agencies and private landowners having doubled the number of even-aged clear-cut stands that are no longer being traditionally clear-cut from 38% to 77%, that's not progress. If the changes that have occurred in looking at ecosystems more broadly and at landscapes more broadly and species more holistically isn't progress, I'm not sure what progress is.
And have those things made a difference? Is there a level that we can demonstrate that it has changed?
Well, I think
or are these things that will take years?
Well, I think that change is an ongoing process in forest management and will continue as it has. I think for myself, when I go out on logging jobs and harvested sites with my members who are loggers all over the state, you see a significant amount of change, whether it's redistribution of the unused material, the slash around the site to provide habitat for wildlife species, or if it's leaving more inclusions or standing live and standing dead timber for a different species. I think you see some significant changes.
Jim Sanders with the Superior National Forest, let's give you a chance to jump in on this.
Has
there been progress?
Oh, yes. And I think what we have to look at in forestry or in natural resource management is that it's an art and science. And as we move forward, we're more into the art than we are into the science. We base our management of natural resources, be it the timber, be it the wildlife, or the habitats that we have out there, on our science. But there is no definitive answer at any one point in time, and the art becomes in how you put that scientific basis to application on the ground.
I would agree with that, but I don't think we've applied it in this case. Um, 70%, greater than 70% of the Chippewa National Forest, for example, is still being managed primarily for the main goal of perpetuating fast-growing young-aged trees such as aspen to meet the needs of just a few industries, the paper and wafer board industries. Over 86% on the Superior National Forest outside the boundary waters is managed this way as well. If you're looking at have we accomplished the goal of making our forests more diverse for the variety of plants and animals and people needs from these forests, I think the answer still is no.
Our phone lines are open for your questions and comments today. The number 1-800-537-5252. And we have a lot of people already waiting on the phone. We will start with Clyde in Minneapolis. Good afternoon, Clyde.
Hello. I'd like to ask Wayne Brandt about the proposed industry alternative for the master plans of the Chippewa and the Superior National Forest. I understand your proposal is to double the harvest level on the Superior National Forest. I guess my concern is that that means redefining a lot of areas that have been protected as part of the timber base. It may mean making some questionable assumptions about how much yield there will be after our next wave of foreign exotic insects sweep through the Midwest. And it also means assumptions about logging practices, which may not protect our riparian areas. So my concern is that I'm not sure that doubling the harvest level in the Superior National Forest is really moving in the right direction.
Well, Clyde raises an interesting question about the alternative that we, through Minnesota Forest Industries, have proposed on the two forests. I would not want the listeners to think that we as the industry started looking at volumes. The analytical process that we went through to develop this alternative was to go back and look at the best research that we were able to find on historical disturbance patterns on the two forests, and to then from that calculate out what that would mean given the reserves in the Boundary Waters Canoe area and the various federal legislation that prohibits harvesting in certain areas, to then look at that and try and mimic what occurred historically through particularly fire but also through windstorms, to mimic that with harvest. On the Superior National Forest, it does in fact yield a very substantial increase in the potential acres to be harvested, far less so on the Chippewa. But when you look at the Superior, I think you have to understand that in the present management plan, there's only about a third of the Superior National Forest that's even considered for management. You've got the BWCA with over 1 million acres that's off limits, and no one is suggesting that that change in any way, shape, or form. And then you've got some 400,000 or 500,000 acres that in the previous plan were not considered because of economic reasons. We think the right way to go about the forest plan revisions is to look at the ecology and to look at it at a landscape and ecosystem level, and not to look at it in a process of going through and zoning the forest that we're going to have only this use in this area, only that use in that area. We think that runs contrary to what the chief of the Forest Service has said. We think it runs contrary to good resource management and the directions through the Forest Resources Council and other processes that we've been heading to here in Minnesota.
Jim Sanders, let's hear from you. You are the supervisor of the Superior National Forest, which actually begins 50 miles north of us here in Duluth, runs up to the Canadian border, almost borders Lake Superior on the other side.
Well, let's talk about first what the role of the Superior National Forest, or what the role of National Forest, is across the country in that public land. You know, it's better, we were established as through law or policy that we don't focus on any one dominant issue or resource. We're there to deal with, yes, the timber resource, with the outdoor recreation, with the wildlife habitat, with water quality. Our mission is for multiple uses and not to focus on one to dominate over the other, and to try to bring that to the landscape.
And you are not required to make money.
We are not required to make money. We are attempting and will work always, whether it's in our recreation program, our timber program, even our wilderness program, to be very efficient in how we implement that mandate in the management on the ground.
And is there a proposal on the table to double the cutting in the Superior National Forest?
Yeah, what we on the Superior and the Chippewa are in is in the process of revising our 1986 forest plans. Those plans guide the management for those two forests across that entire forest on the federal land only. And what we are asking for, or have asked for at this point, is for some extensive involvement from the public, collaboration, if you would call, to help us in developing the various alternatives. And we're obligated to look for a range of alternatives. Yes, there are alternatives that has been proposed or developed from the industry, Minnesota Forest Industries that Wayne talked about, that talks about focuses heavier on the harvest to deal with those historic conditions that took place and disturbance regimes that have happened on our forests over the years. And then we have proposals from other groups. The Sierra Club has put one together that would go to the other side. Audubon,
so everybody's got a plan.
You bet.
But do you, in your position, think that the Superior National Forest could sustain double the cutting that's being done there now?
At this point, given the regulations that we have in place, I wouldn't say we were looking at doubling the cutting or going to zero on the cutting. It's trying to find that harvest pattern, or let's talk about the forest we want, the landscape we want across the Superior or the Chippewa, and through that, through maintaining water quality, habitat for wildlife or fisheries or whatever, then we will have some alterations to that forest, and that will be at some level.
And the decision will have to be made when?
We will be looking at providing a draft environmental impact statement next fall, and then a final in about 2 years.
If I could just jump in here, too, just to set the stage, I think many of your listeners heard in the series previous that Minnesota's northern forests used to be, previously were very diverse forests, mixtures of different tree types and different ages, a real mosaic. And through the focus on providing fiber for the paper and wafer board industries, we have radically simplified our forests. We have a forest that is becoming not a whole lot more diverse than a cornfield, with just the proliferation of young-aged aspen everywhere. This is not balanced forest management. And Jim is right when he says that the national forests have a mandate to provide for the variety of needs and uses of our public forest lands. What Wayne is proposing with doubling the harvest on the Superior National Forest is they've had almost all of the pie. Now they want it completely. This is,
oh, Betsy, that's just nonsense. And you know,
Wayne, this,
I mean,
can't
on the Superior National
Forest
in the current plan, there's only a third of the acres that are even considered for management. And the notion that we're somehow converting massive amounts of the state's forest land, let alone the national forest, to a simplified cover type goes against all of the research and information out there.
Wayne, I just disagree. The research...
I know you disagree, but unfortunately you're wrong.
You're talking about 10-year-old information, and in the last 10 years we have dramatically accelerated the harvest here in Minnesota.
The harvest is less today than it was 10 years ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's go to our phone callers, because they are waiting patiently and have many questions and comments that they would like to bring up. We go now to St. Paul. Good afternoon, Lars.
Good afternoon. This is somewhat directed at Superior National Forest, but it's the land that really adjoins it, and that's owned by Minnesota Power. And what I've been seeing is Minnesota Power leasing off small sections to small logging companies, or kind of small family-run logging companies, that go in, lease the land for 100 years, they go in, cut their wood, and they leave. And there doesn't seem like there's much management going on. That land is just left, and it becomes aspen scrub after that. What's the responsibility of Minnesota Power, and what is the, you know, and it's more on the private land ownership issue of, you know, the small loggers going in and pulling off $5,000-$10,000 worth of land and leaving scrub aspen there, and it really destroys the land that's around it, and also Superior National Forest that adjoins the Minnesota Power land.
I don't mean to speak for Minnesota Power, but I have some familiarity with their land management program. To the best of my knowledge, they don't do any kind of long-term timber leases. They do have a program where they lease lakeshore lots to individuals on the long term. The state of Minnesota also, through the last couple of sessions, has bought a substantial amount of the riverfront property they had on the St. Louis River to protect that on into the future. In terms of their management of the timberland that they own, I know that they employ a number of professional foresters and have got a staff and a process they go through, but it's not any kind of long-term leasing arrangement.
We go north to Side Lake for our next phone call. Good afternoon, Max.
Hello.
Good afternoon. Go ahead with your question and comment.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I've been listening here intently. This is an excellent program, but one important aspect that has not been at all addressed yet is the role of fire in the forest. The boreal forest in particular is a fire ecosystem, and I don't think we can talk effectively about the forests without addressing fire. Excuse me. And if possible, I'd like each of your guests to talk a little bit about fire ecology and fire in the forest from their perspective, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Max. Jim, let's start with you again. You supervise the Superior National Forest. Briefly, the role of fire?
Well, our forests in the Northwoods of Minnesota are forests that have developed with fire as a key ingredient to that development of those forests. And as we look at that, is one disturbance regime that is out there that took place before European settlement the Native Americans used. We, through a disturbance inside the boundary waters, we will look at allowing fire to continue to roll under certain circumstances, under conditions that will be beneficial, because we know we need to bring fire back into that system. Outside the boundary waters, we are looking at tools for that disturbance, in some cases to maintain that disturbance. Some places we will bring fire into it, or we will use timber harvest to replicate that disturbance, or where there isn't a commercial product or and it's unsafe to bring fire in, we'll use some mechanical treatment to bring that disturbance regime in.
Betsy, is fire any less painful than cutting?
Well, fire, as Jim said, it's absolutely a natural part of these system, of these forest systems, and has a place in them. And I think it highlights the caller's point, highlights the issue of we need to get away from doing the same thing everywhere. Our forests are diverse. They need to be treated in a diverse management approach. And 80% of the way we log in Minnesota, or more than 80%, is by clear cutting. That doesn't achieve that balance, that variety that we need. And fire is one aspect that we can introduce and bring in and try using as a management tool to add a little more diversity to what we're doing.
Wayne Brandt, your thoughts?
Fire is nature's clear cut, and it's not a pretty thing, and it probably has very little likelihood with the numbers of people who own property, whether they're hunting cabins or lake places. The property owners in our northern forests certainly aren't going to want to see a substantial reintroduction of fire. So while it has been an important part of the ecosystem and the Forest Service, as Jim points out, within the boundary waters utilizes it, we don't think it's going to be, the risks are too high to let wildfires burn.
We have a logger on the phone from the town of Finland. Good afternoon, Corey.
Yes, I want to first say that I listen to NPR and my harvesting equipment out here in the woods, and I'm on my cellular phone right now calling in because it's a very good program. NPR is great, and I'm glad to see everybody that's on the panel that gets to talk. But anyway, my thoughts that I wanted to mention on the show here were that diversity is a necessary thing that we need to have out in the woods, and all the different interests that are involved in that, the DNR, the paper companies themselves. We were talking about the goshawk earlier in the first hour, and I work for Potlatch, and they just had a wildlife guy out here painting areas off and talking about the goshawk and its territory. They're highly motivated in finding out goshawk territory. They have them mapped on GPS. I don't know which way I want to put it, but they're very deep into this diversity of the forest and trying to look ways to promote the forest. I mean,
so Corey, are you comfortable, Corey, that the forests are being protected but can still be logged?
Definitely so. I mean, and the big part of it is you don't realize it. Like Wayne had mentioned earlier, that people have to get out of their cars and go actually look. I mean, I think a lot of these people are, you know, I think the biggest crime is all the pavement in all the cities that people, that's where they're calling from, I think that's the worst crime. Out here, the forests are regrowing, and much to the efforts of the paper companies being interested and involved in it. One of the foresters for Potlatch, I don't want to use his name, but you'll know if he's listening, but he said, I'd like to put a bumper sticker on my vehicle and say, I've planted 2 million trees this year. How many have you planted? For the people who call in to talk about how the forests are, the state of the forest in Minnesota. So.
Thank you, Corey, for your call today. We go now down to Minneapolis, where Doug is waiting on the phone. Hello, Doug.
Hi. This question really is posed to someone who's not on the panel, but I think maybe Betsy and Jim Sanders might respond to it. I'm talking about old forests which are unfragmented. And you talked about one earlier at Big Lake Seven Beaver. Another one is just on the western boundary of the BWCA. It's called Little East Creek Forest. And that forest has been left largely untouched by harvesting and roads since the early part of the century. In the original mosaic, there was a lot of pine in there. Right now, according to the U.S. Forest Service, their own vegetative type map for the area, there's only one stand that is large enough of white pine left in the area that it has a designation as a white pine cover type in this 20-square-mile area, one small area. That area is going to be scheduled to be cut by the DNR this winter. The white pines are up to 200 years old. Some of them are younger. The ones that are younger are dying of blister rust. The older ones are healthy, the seed trees. The seed trees are the ones that are going to be cut. This represents cutting of white pine, which, as you know, is only less than 1% of original white pine left in northern Minnesota. What do you think about that? Yeah, my question is, what do you think about that practice, and why not convince the DNR that they ought to buy back that those trees from Boise Cascade, who's bid on them successfully?
Betsy. Well, I think that's a great idea. We certainly know that white pine is a very treasured, rare resource here in Minnesota. I think what Doug is bringing up is a problem that plagues Minnesota, which is we don't have good communication from the Minnesota DNR about what they're planning, where they're planning to do something. There's not a process for notifying the public or involving the public in any meaningful ways, and so we have these last-minute surprise discoveries that at the 11th hour, and trying to resolve them they're never resolved to anybody's satisfaction, and it's an unfortunate occurrence. The Forest Service, however, does have a public involvement notification process, and I think Minnesota's DNR would do well to try to emulate that so that we can. We live in a democratic society, and anytime you try to public land management agencies, when they're not allowing the public to be involved in knowing what's happening and what's going to happen in their backyard and to their public resources, I think you need to start being nervous about why it is they don't want the public knowing what they're doing.
Jim, your comment. I know one of the goals of the Superior National Forest is to preserve the white pines for as long as you can, the older white pines.
Yeah, we are actively trying to manage and maintain and enhance white pine. That was a subject of part of the debate around the sale last winter up in the Orr area, but we've planted in the last couple of years over 1 million seedlings of white pine and have timber sales underway that are out to specifically help to regenerate white pine.
And your great-great-great-grandchildren. We'll enjoy those.
Very much so, and that's the objective, is what we leave and do today is what will there be there for those, all of our children, into the future. But my role and our role on the federal or Forest Service land is not to dictate what will happen on the other non-federal ownerships, and that is within their purview of how and they go about their management. For our national forest land, as Betsy said, we have a very open, involved public involvement process and welcome and want that public to be involved.
Time-consuming and expensive process, but it works.
Well, yes, but that's what we're on.
What
on the federal public lands, that's part of the process that is embedded in that, and it does work. It's not easy, it's not clean, and it gets very messy along the way, but that's part of the debate we're having.
And it might be interesting to note that the Superior and the Chippewa National Forest, our two national forests in Minnesota, represent just 12%
of the forest lands in this state.
That's correct, yes.
I do think it's unfair, though, to suggest that there's no opportunity for public input or public involvement in the DNR processes. They have a process. They do have opportunities for public input. They're certainly not as bureaucratically complex as has been created by the Congress and the courts for the Forest Service, but it's not that they're off in some deep, dark corner making decisions. They are very responsive to the public and to state elected officials.
You're listening to a special Main Street show on Minnesota's timber industry. I'm Rachel Reby, and we're broadcasting from the Minnesota Public Radio studios of WSCN, WSCD in Duluth. My guests today, Jim Sanders of the Superior National Forest and Betsy Dobb of the National Audubon Society. They're here with me in Duluth. Wayne Brandt of the Minnesota Forest Industries is joining us from our St. Paul studio. Our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. If you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, call us at 1-800-537-5252. We now go to Bemidji. Good afternoon, Judy.
Thank you. Thank you for this very interesting program. I have a comment and then a question. I agree with Betsy in that the pie is getting smaller, and there's pressures from all areas on our forests. And example, the cutting is increasing. Here in Beltrami County, on all ownerships, 152,821 cords were harvested in 1996. 1997, it went up to 312,952 cords, all species for pulpwood. So there are pressures. And the industry is reluctant, in fact hostile, to guidelines that might be mandated on forest practices. They want everything to be voluntary. I have gotten out of my car, and I have walked a lot of the woods, and I have not seen where voluntary guidelines have particularly worked. Now, my question is to Wayne Brandt. You want things voluntary. I'm going to shift positions a little bit here, and I'm going to ask you, sir, why doesn't your industry voluntarily shift over to production of paper from post-consumer waste? I've been using it for 5 years. It's my preference. I do not use bleached white paper. I do not, and I think if the public were given the choice, I think they, and the prices were, would come down, they would choose to purchase post-consumer or paper made from post-consumer waste. Now,
well,
that's
Brand,
something
your
you could voluntarily
to that
do. Okay.
The caller raises an interesting point on the use of recycled fiber. The forest products industry nationally and here in this state have been part of increasing the amount of recovered paper from some 28% to 45% in the past 9 years. That has been accomplished with the investment of in excess of $12 billion nationwide. Here in Minnesota, if you look back 10 years, there were very limited amounts of recycled content paper being produced. Now there's some 23 different grades that are being produced by our paper companies, and that's all been done in a voluntary way. And as consumers, and the caller indicates that she is one of those consumers that seeks out recycled content paper, as more and more consumers do that, that's what gets made. Paper companies don't wake up in the morning having some unquenchable desire to make a product that people don't want to buy, that their customers don't want to buy, and they will make what the demand is out there for.
So, Betsy, do you see your job is trying to convince consumers that white paper is not good, paper made from recycled is better?
Well, I think that's all of our jobs, in a sense, is to educate people about how much we consume in this society and ways that we can consume less and take less of the natural resources that we need. I would also add, a couple of different callers have touched on a few issues of economics and how we provide for people and wildlife for the long term. And I think I think many people would be interested in looking at what industry has proposed for both the Chippewa and the Superior National Forest. And if you look at their own graphs, they're proposing over the next 100 years, two cycles of booms and busts for those forests and those forest communities. In other words, high harvest levels and then rock bottom harvest levels. This is not good, sustainable forestry for, this is not good for the loggers, this is not good for logging families, this is not good for the communities that depend on these jobs, and it certainly isn't good for the forests. And I would just add that what Audubon is about is enlightened, improved forest management, and we have worked with citizens for over a year to gather information and form a vision that is more balanced, that is providing for people to have incomes from the forest, but also providing for the array of plants and animals.
Wayne Brandt, would you like to respond to that, the boom and bust cycles?
Gee, I wish Betsy would have called and posed that question to us and the analytical folks that we had work on it. That's clearly not what we've proposed in the cycles that she shows, and we'd be happy to chat with her about those graphs. Are evened out in what we propose for the forest, because we certainly don't want to see boom and busts out there, and that's not our intent. We think that as part of this alternative development process, that the Forest Service ought to be looking at a broad range of ideas about how to manage them, and I frankly find it a little offensive to be attacked on NPR for forwarding an idea that's an ecologically based approach.
Wayne, that's an ecological, your vision is based on disturbance patterns in the boreal forest, which do not occur here in Minnesota. We don't have any boreal forests, so your model is based on an ecosystem in Canada.
Let's let Jim Sanders get into this conversation.
Yeah, it's our process that's being debated, and I guess we're seeing the level of how that public involvement works. And what we're looking for, as Wayne pointed out, and as Betsy's provided in their alternative through is that wide range, and that's what we're obligated to look for, is that wide range of alternatives for how to manage the Superior National Forest.
You have
Chippewa
a difficult
National
job,
Forest.
Don't
oh,
you?
Oh, yeah, it's difficult, complex, and exciting all at the same time.
We go to St. Paul now, where John waits on the line. Good afternoon, John.
Hi. I've got a few questions here. And
let's take your most important question, John.
Okay, as a hunter and a trapper, and I've done some blogging in the past, too, so I've been out of my car looking, and I can see what's being done, and it's really changed quite a bit over logging practices of, say, even 10 years ago, where they used to do clear cuts in, say, a 10 to 40, possibly even an 80-acre section. Now there's hundreds of acres being clear cut at a time. And it's happening really quick, and the practices being used right now seem to really affect, like, the surface hydrology of the area, where the runoff going through streams or skidding through streams, they're harvesting during the summertime when the soil's more affected. I'm wondering, after generations of this, of monocropping aspen, what will we have left for future generations of Minnesotans? I mean, what will happen to the soil communities?
Jim, do you want to respond to that?
No. What will happen or not happen based on that, that's where we go through an extensive analysis of any project or proposed timber sale we have to try, with our expertise that we have on the forest, our hydrologists, soil scientists, ecologists, to take a look at what is being proposed, both not only at the site level right where the logging is taking place, but how does that fit into the landscape, that becomes part of the quilt or the pattern for there. And I think you could see also on the public, on the Federal Forest Service lands, that harvest patterns have changed. We have differences in sizes of the harvest units, because recognizing you need small harvests, you need large units, you need different patches or trees remaining within those. It's looking for that diversity, but not only at the site level, but across the landscape to try to provide that, and not to go for just one species or the other. It's our intent for planting white pine or all. This year, half of our harvest was in commercial thinning and red pine stands that were planted back in the Civilian Conservation Corps days. So our harvests, our patterns are changing on much of the landscape.
As you may have heard in the series prior, over 4 years ago, the Minnesota State completed a study, a massive study of the impacts of timber harvesting on the environment. And despite some of the flaws in that study that might have actually underestimated the impacts of harvesting, it had some alarming predictions, and we need to pay attention to those predictions. They were saying that if we don't even change the way we harvest and the rate that we harvest our forests today, just looking at bird species alone, 39 species of birds may experience significant population declines without doing anything different than what we're doing today. This is of a concern to us and should be a concern to all of Minnesotans. 50 years from now, which is the length of time that this study was looking out into the future, and I have a 20-month-old daughter who turns 20 months old today. When she's 50 years from now, I don't want her looking back and saying, gee, they really screwed up. They didn't do a very good job of taking care of these resources, because sure enough, 50 years from now, those predictions became a reality. We have an opportunity today to try to be more conservative and more caring and more thoughtful in how we care for our forest. Let's not mess it up. This is a rare opportunity.
I think Betsy also highlights one of the things that I think many of us that have been involved in these issues have experienced, and that was mentioned in one of the segments in the previous hour, and that is the GEIS information. She, you know, cites the 39 figure. You can also look at the figures that show the number of species of birds increasing. I think one of the things that we all struggle with, whether it's the National Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, the forest products industry, the private property rights people, or anyone else, is so many of these issues are very heavily value-driven. And one group of people has one set of values that they believe deeply in. Another group has another set of values that may impact how they view whether game species are relatively more important than species of birds that we would want to simply look at, or whether motorized recreational activities are most important, or the
solitude. So that's
why
the discussion at the table is so lively, because people are coming in with a whole different set of expectations and priorities.
I think that's absolutely correct, and I think that one of the things here in Minnesota that we have that is a structural advantage, if you will, versus some of the areas out west, is we have got a variety of land ownership, and those landowners, be they the federal government, the state government, county government, Native American tribes, private individuals, or the forest industry, have a mosaic of goals, and the interrelationship of them and the values that people bring to each of those areas and how they choose to use or not use their land are very important to all of us.
And we have a landowner waiting on the phone with us today. Charles, you're calling from Independence.
Yes, I'd just like to comment on my experiences. We have a private owners up in northern Minnesota, and have a small 180-acre piece of property that 40 of it was cleared and 148 were timbered. And when we looked at long-term management, we first were relatively suspicious of the corporate agencies, and looked at some nonprofit organizations come in and take a look and give us some recommendations. However, we were really surprised. Our best recommendations came from Potlatch. We told them what we wanted. We wanted a long-term, small-scale, mixed forest so that we'd have a diversity, and for songbirds and ruffed grouse. And they came in and listened to exactly what we want, came in with a biologist to walk the property, cruise the property, and we ended up with a long-term plan where we took, we clear-cutted four, trying to do a Gillian sort of approach to forest management. We but had to compromise with, the Gillian approach would be 1 acre a year, you know, in a 40 or so. We did four small 4 acre clear cuts, a total of 16 acres out of the 140, and then hope to do it again in about 10 years with a set aside approximately 25 to 30% of it to not mess with at all. And the Potlatch experience was just incredibly positive. Their biologist came in, recognized what we wanted, marked off sites where we for raptors, and it was just a great experience, and I was quite surprised.
And Jim, you'd like to respond to that?
Well, I think the caller just exhibits what is the uniqueness that comes to the Northwoods of Minnesota, and that is the diversity that we need. We all can agree that we need diversity across the landscape, and part of that diversity comes from the ownership patterns that we have and the objectives and intentions for how individuals will treat their land, as the caller is talking about, because there's no one answer, no one way, nor should there be one way to treat every acre. because it is that diversity we have both in harvest and non-harvest, whether it's inside the boundary waters, outside the boundary waters, private land, industrial lands, or federal or state land. Those approaches will bring the diversity, not only in ownership, but the diversity in our forests that we need to deal with the variety of species we have. I think what your series is pointing out, you talk about in the heavy logging that took place in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The forests we have today that we're debating about demonstrate the resiliency of our forests, of our natural resources. And we're debating and talking about how to use those forests that have responded and rebounded. They are different than what they were before that harvesting, but that's what we're debating about, is that resiliency and where we go from here.
Our next phone caller is calling us from Minneapolis. Good afternoon, Laura.
Hi, my name is Laura McLeod. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota, and I've also done quite a bit of research at the White Earth Indian Reservation. And my primary research interest is the importance of harvesting for the vitality of Native cultures in northern Minnesota. And time and time again, people have told me and shown me how clear-cutting is destroying not only their traditional harvesting sites, but also destroying their cultural values and their cultural ways that they would like to pass on to their children. And I hear the word diversity quite a bit, but there's one piece that seems to be missing, which I think is missing in the GEIS as well, and that's a recognition of the link between cultural diversity and biological diversity. And I know the GEIS looks at cultural resources of Native peoples, but primarily that's the burial sites, grave sites, archaeological artifacts, and not...
And we need to expand our viewpoint. Then.
Right, not the needs of what people need today in terms of a living, standing, healthy, diverse forest. And I know that aspen regenerates quickly, but for a person who picks medicines to treat their community, the illnesses in their community, medicines don't grow in aspen groves, and not too many animals grow in aspen groves or berries that they would traditionally pick.
Let's give Betsy a chance to respond to that. Betsy, go ahead.
You've hit a very important issue, absolutely, right on the nose, and it gets back to, again, trying to provide our forests to meet the needs of all different kinds of people and all the different values. And the cultural values, the spiritual values associated with our forests are also critical. The people, the citizens that Audubon's been working with for over a year to provide visions for the National Forest in Minnesota have said that that needs to be something that these two forests take a much greater attention to in the next decade and beyond, that we do need to be providing for traditional gathering of forest products and traditional hunting and fishing.
And Betsy, before we go to our next call, for those people who are listening who do not know what GEIS means, give us the shortest definition you can.
It was a state-sponsored study that was commissioned and began in 1990 and finished in 1994. It took 4 years and $1 billion worth of taxpayer money to examine what the impacts might be from timber harvesting on Minnesota's environment.
Let's go to Phil in Spring Lake Park. Good afternoon, Phil.
Hi. Thanks for this conversation. Thanks for taking my call. I think this kind of conversation of all the diverse opinions is really what's needed. And my comment along that line is I'm a big aficionado of our state park system. And we have an absolutely terrific state park system that has an absolute preservationist mandate. Then on the other hand, we're talking about use of forest resources sort of on the order of harvesting or mining the living world. And it seems to me we need more of the conversation between those two extremes so that it should be pretty easy to agree that we're going to, of course, save this large tract of old-growth white pine, or of course this area is environmentally sensitive, or it houses some interesting rare species, and so of course we will preserve this and not log it, or we'll only take something very minimally, maybe taking a couple of large valuable trees rather than clear cutting. I guess I have difficulty understanding why this conversation is so difficult.
I think it's so difficult, as the caller points out, and we chatted about earlier, because of the values that we all have and bring to the table. And I think that the state of Minnesota and the citizens can be proud of some of the processes that we have gone through here, whether it's the generic environmental impact statement or the roundtable that followed that up, or the activities of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, where you've got 14 diverse viewpoints coming together to hopefully drive the car down the center lane without any oncoming traffic.
Just tag on to what Wayne talked about there. I think you're right. The debate is over the emotional part, and that's the different values that we bring to it. My experience in natural resource management has spanned more than Minnesota, and be it the Pacific Northwest, the interior Rocky Mountains, or even Washington, D.C. And what I see, what we are doing in Minnesota is unique and outstanding, because we are bringing the interests together. And is there fast or quick solutions? No, because these are not quick, easy problems as we're seeing right now. If anything, they're more confusing the more you talk about them. But we have the people at the table. In what form, that is, you know, you can continue to evolve. But what's important is everybody is sitting down, we're talking about it, we're working our way through it, because the resources will be what benefits from that process. And that's what's key and unique in what we have going on here.
Do people have a mind to compromise, though? Do they have a heart for compromise? Or, Betsy, is that sort of the problem here, that bring people in from very, and we've heard it during this show today, from very diverse points of view and very cemented points of view, and say, now let's come up with a consensus? Does that work?
Well, I think the chance it has of working is if no one party is greedy and wants, either digs in their heels and says, we refuse to acknowledge there needs to be change, or we refuse in our actions to acknowledge that there needs to be change, or wants to just continue to hang on to what they've got. And we won't be able to meet all those different values and needs of our forests if that happens.
And you're willing to give a little.
I think that's what this is about, is that the scales have been tipped so far in one direction. So, I mean, we're looking at the majority of our northern forests are being managed by clear cutting, and the majority of our two national forests are managed for the primary purpose of meeting the needs of a few industries. That's not balanced. And so what we're saying is, yeah, we need to restore that balance. We need to be able to meet the needs of people who want to recreate, who want to make a living in the forest, who want that connection spiritually and culturally.
Wayne Brandt, do you feel like the scale has been tipped towards industry?
You know, my members get so frustrated, whether they're the logger out there who has invested $700,000 or $800,000 in equipment and is employing his neighbor and her children, whether it's the companies that have hired wildlife biologists and hydrologists to do a better job. It's so frustrating to be constantly attacked and to not receive any significant acknowledgement for the changes that have occurred in practices, for the investments that have been made in equipment, and for the support that we have put behind a whole host of things, whether it's the DNR surveying and establishing old growth reserves, whether it's the preparation of extended rotation programs on different ownerships, whether it's the investment of some $40 million in new logging equipment.
So you feel there has been compromise on your side, that you have come with a mood and a mindset for compromise?
We think that we've got an awfully good track record of acknowledging where there are ways that we can do things better, acknowledging where there are problems, and actually putting our shoulders to the wheel, whether it's supporting legislation, supporting processes, programs, or the actual spending of money to make a difference on the ground. We think that we've got a pretty good track record, and you know, I think it's our pledge, and I know it's our pledge to the citizens of Minnesota, that we're going to keep changing and we're going to continue to do the best job that we can. We're not going to see massive dislocations of the people that we represent. We don't think that that's necessary, but we're going to continue to change as the knowledge changes, and forest practices, which are different today than they were 10 or 20 years ago, will be different 10 and 20 years
into
the future.
Let's go back to the phone call. Charles is waiting in Minneapolis to make a question or comment. Good afternoon, Charles.
Yes, I'd like to to comment in this very interesting program about a couple of things that I find myself listening to. It involves language, and as the speaker just was talking about change, and your question, actually, whether it's swinging towards industry. I mean, first of all, you have to imagine that all of Minnesota was mowed. It's pretty much been an industrial kind of a process that's been happening, and it still reflects in words that we use to describe nature, such as resources. Though we use what we have around us, it's not just a resource, it's the source of life. And I'd like to ask the question that is in my mind that has to do with the wild, which I guess I would pick another word to use, and that would be free, because it has a different connotation. The one we can sort of think about hooligans with spray cans when we think of wild, but the unmanaged aspect of nature, that nature that got along for billions of years without us, don't you think that it would be more appropriate, and don't you think this is happening now, and this is the wonderful news, that we're starting finally to be forced by our limited amount of resources that we have on this planet to manage ourselves better? Isn't that what everybody's really talking about around that table right now? That's so beautiful. Can you comment on this, everybody?
Yeah, I think it's all our responsibility, whether it's in our recycling programs or the technology that's come to bear in how the logging practices or any other practice happens out on the ground or in how we use those resources we have. I mean, we consume more wood products by ton than any other raw material in the United States, and that's our challenge, is how to take and go farther. The previous, some of the earlier segments in the program talked about they only took out the lower portion of the tree. We use, the technology has expanded to wafer board, to particle board, to I-beam construction, where it's not the solid 2x12 or 14 that goes into those four boards. That, it's a whole combination across that. It's all our responsibilities to move forward and then talk about what is it we want that landscape to look like, our forest to look like, and not so much the tools, how we get there.
Time for one more phone call. We go to Minneapolis. Good afternoon, John.
My question is, with taxpayers paying $800 million a year, according to Forest Service figures, to subsidize corporations logging on our national forests, and 70% of the American public believing we shouldn't even be logging on national forests, isn't it time we get the corporate interests out of our national forests and stop logging them?
Jim, you want to respond to that?
As far as our Minnesota National Forest, they're operated on the lowest unit cost of any of the national forests in the country and have been at or above cost on a timber sale perspective. I mean, we're looking at, these are dynamic landscapes. They're going to change with us or without us, and it's how we deal with that.
If I can think as a parent, I think there's a lot of parents out there. I think we want our children to grow up with places where they can see the variety, the marvelous variety of life around them, where they can follow in our footsteps and work in the forests, where they can form that spiritual, cultural connection with the land. And those are the variety of different things that our national public forests and our other public forest lands can do.
We're out of time this afternoon. Wayne Brandt, Betsy Dobb, and Jim Sanders, thank you for being with us today. This special Main Street Radio broadcast is a production of Minnesota Public Radio. Our engineers are Rick Hibzinski in Duluth, Jenny Lubke in St. Paul. Our producer is Sarah Meyer, executive producer Mel Summer, site producer Bob Kelleher. We'd like to thank the staff of WSCN and WSCD for allowing us to bring you this show from Duluth. We invite you to visit the Main Street website. Go to www.mpr.org. You'll be able to hear this broadcast as well as other Main Street reports. The address again, www.mpr.org. NPR's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant-making, leadership training, and convening. Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street team consists of 12 reporters at NPR bureaus across Minnesota. I'm Rachel Reby.